Hello. Just a brief reminder that Jordan and Tim and I were talking in this episode about Christianity and Jordan's recent conversion to Christianity in the past year or so. I just want to remind everybody that we decided intentionally not to have Jordan rehash his whole story of how he got there. I'd like to point people to Jordan's appearance on the Emerge podcast and on the Jim Rutt show to hear the background of that story. But instead of rehashing the story again, we decided to go a little deeper in different themes and more specific takes on the experience of it. But if you want to know the background, I'd recommend listening to one of those two podcasts first and then listening to this one. Thanks. All right. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Doomer Optimism. We have Jordan Hall back on the podcast, and I have Tim, otherwise known as Mashton Timmy on Twitter, here joining us. We are going to be talking a little bit about religion today. Jordan somewhat famously recently became a Christian. Tim also somewhat recently became a Christian and sort of shared his experiences on Twitter, and Tim and I were going back and forth, like, we need to find a time to hear your experience. And then, you know, when this information with Jordan came up and he's been doing the podcast circuit, I figured it was a good opportunity to sort of get both of their stories. And we can hear a little bit about their background, but there's some similarity in the fact that I think Tim and Jordan, at least in my mind, both occupy this like very thoughtful, intellectual, maybe somewhat rationalist. Jordan for sure in the Sivium, Gamebee, liminal web world. A lot of people who are, I guess, involved in tech and sort of like ra very rationalist thinking, sort of followed along on Jordan's intellectual journey. So this is like a big shift, I think. And I think something worth exploring in depth, maybe more than one podcast. But I'm going to start by having Tim introduce himself, talk a little bit about his journey, and then you can throw out the first questions.
Sure. Hi, thanks for having me. Big fan of both of you guys, so it's exciting to be able to talk to you. I've been listening to Jordan for a long time. So yeah, I'm Tim. Just similar kind of space, like Ashley was saying, in kind of the tech world a little bit of the rationalist world, and really been in the kind of homesteading slash trad world of Twitter, whatever exactly that is. So it's mostly getting yelled at by Neil J. Clark, Boiled Owl on Twitter. He's been my favorite arc there. But yeah, over the last year or so, I kind of decided to convert to Christianity as well. And that journey, I think a lot of what Jordan was sharing was the same sort of thing, right? And I Jordan definitely came from it at a kind of an intellectual angle, and so I'm curious on the more personal angle as well. First though, I'm really curious from Jordan. Like, what's the reaction been, right? You kind of came out, which feels a little funny, but there is something to it, right? It's kind of a big thing to put out there, especially when you know your own preconceptions about Christians going into it. What has it been like? Have you been from What's the reaction from like Christians and non-Christians been like?
Well, I suppose unsurprisingly, but maybe 95% of the Christian reaction has been quite positive. 5% has been, how would I say, either a combination of overbearing. Okay, you're doing this wrong, get in there. And then half of the other 5% has been I mean, cynical, which is, I think, actually quite reasonable. I don't have any. But 95% has been quite heartening. And some of these are people who I know, which has been very beautiful, when they've actually kind of reached out and said, one said it perfectly. She's like, she's got the right vibe. She said, I have been praying for you for 12 years. And a really good friend of mine who I've known for, gosh, since 1994, he said he's been praying, he and his family have been praying for me for decades, and that it was incredibly heartening for him. For him to actually see this transformation in somebody who he felt was very far away. And so I've been having lots of wonderful conversations, to be perfectly honest. It's been, for the most part, quite beautiful. And then on the other side, so far at least, remarkably peaceful. I have not had anybody, you know, I suppose you might say that the gym was a little bit hard on me, Ashley, but that's like the hardest that I've experienced thus far from people who are coming from the not Christian side of things. And, you know, I've got good friends, very good friends, who have either been of a, how do you say it? Congratulations. And I'm interested in having long theological conversations about how you made such an egregious error of judgment, which is nice, right? It's like, hey, this, and by the way, you know, I can't help but sort of notice in underneath that of, so you're saying is that our relationship is more fundamental than our ideology. Interesting. Well, I'm going to argue that's actually the most Christian thing that we can do. And so, well, those will be fun conversations. So far, it's been quite, I would say, even wonderful, to be honest. And I didn't expect that. You know, so I didn't, whenever I got baptized, I want to say 3 months ago, I tried to figure out a way to bind it so I knew more properly. But I didn't share that broadly. I certainly didn't like write a Twitter post about it on day one. I didn't intend to sort of come out at all. But I happened to be at a dinner at Daniel Thorson's house. He's like, he kind of squints his eyes and says, rumor has it you're a Christian now. He didn't say it. He said it not quite like that. And I said, yeah, that's true. And then after they asked me to tell my story, so I did. And he then said, would you be willing to come onto the podcast and talk about it? And I said, well, you know, I'm going to pray on that for a while. Because I felt very mixed emotions, to be honest about it. For lots of reasons, not the least of which is a certain sense of like an unearned authority. I've built a certain degree of, let's say, proper authority in certain domains, but not in this one. Right? And so I don't want people to translate over across those boundaries. I don't, you ask me questions about theology, my answer is going to be, generally speaking, I don't know. Like, I've been looking at it. I look at it a lot. I've spent, you know, a year deeply. A year's not a very long time. I know people who've been spending decades deeply. Obviously, people in history who've spent whole lifetimes on it. So some trepidation, but then, of course, a real responsibility. And beautifully, Daniel and several of the other folks who are in his Dharma house, they came to our church and just actually sat and, you know, I think, experienced it. Then it felt like, okay, let's be on this podcast. And so since then, I've had, gosh, quite a few people have reached out to me. Some I've known in the past, some I haven't, who've wanted to explore different dimensions of it. So I suppose I'll be, whether I like it or not, having some attention. And so I will do my level best to be a proper instrument of the spirit as it expresses itself in the world.
Yeah. I want to throw it back to you, Tim, but I just want to say, it's funny, when I first moved to Uruguay, I was, you know, stewarding some land for the first time and getting invited on these podcasts, like, can you talk about what it's like to steward landscapes? And I'm like, like, you should be asking a farmer about this. But it's like, I think that there's also a real value in somebody who's new to a world, kind of just talking through their new experiences to help other people sort of come through. And I think that was, you know, really helpful with people in homesteading. It's like, actually, somebody who's been doing it for many generations has a harder time translating than somebody who's new to it, can speak the same language, can sort of, you know, mediate between the two worlds. So I think that's helpful. Tim, what was your experience coming out?
I definitely did not have the challenges Jordan has, right? So I'm going to want him to give a brief kind of overview of his kind of involvement in like a religion that's not a religion, right? I imagine that like that's a hard thing to kind of attach your name with, engage with, and then have to then say, okay, I've rethought it, right? So I didn't have that, but it was definitely, for me, it was more of a, I think, more intensely personal. Definitely was like, I think people get converted in a lot of different ways and come to the Lord in a lot of different ways. A lot, you know, I had your classic midlife crisis, right? So like everything that could possibly be going wrong was going wrong. You know, marriage was not in a good spot. And, but kind of going through that, kind of felt the same thing that a lot of people have been expressing online, just this lack of meaning, right? Became successful in a little software business and kind of had all these things I planned on it. I'd have to, you know, wait my entire career to kind of achieve. And all of a sudden kind of had all the material needs taken care of that I needed. I moved out to 10 acres of land and was spending time outside a lot. And so you could see kind of the Lord just working in different ways. I think like the connection to nature was a huge thing for me. Didn't expect that to kind of like soften my heart in a way that it did. So it was a lot of intense personal stuff, right? Like this idea of like grace, for instance, like just needing that as a human being, needing to experience that was super powerful for me. And I'm curious, like on, you know, Jordan, when you were kind of going through it, what were like the aspects of Christianity that hit you in a way that you didn't expect? What were those things that you found that you didn't know you were missing?
Well, first, as I'm hearing you, I'm reminded of actually reading your long tweet about your journey. I just want to say to express my gratitude. I felt like it was a beautiful piece, and I really appreciated the quality of care that was just shining through it. So thank you.
No, thanks for saying. I feel compelled to share it, right? Because I think people don't talk about it enough, especially people that are kind of outside of it. Once you're in a Christian community, right, it's all completely different, right?
So that's maybe one. So funny. So one of the things that I've definitely noticed is that the secular world is struggling mightily to almost the image of the bedsheet, like a too small bedsheet, of trying to kind of pull the bedsheet of secular to cover things that are currently deeply uncovered. And so on the West Coast, we have this kind of cult of pseudo-intimacy and pseudo-vulnerability, which bridges very heavily with, say, the New Age and or the Burning Man subset. You're on an adequate amount of MDMA, you have a very strong felt sense of intimacy and vulnerability. But to actually experience what the non-pseudo version of that is in the context of the Christian environment was really quite potent. And the beauty of it, the ability to actually have this feeling of, it's so hard to explain, like authenticity that's authentic. Like it's in every case, it is really just saying, the thing that we have been talking about and seeking is actually just available here in its true form. Maybe that's the easiest way to put it.
Yep.
Not trying to be authentic, but in fact, just being authentic. Not trying to be intimate, but in fact, being intimate.
Yeah, and that resonates in a big way, right? Like it was like a surprising thing to me that like church actually works, right? you want to think like it's really complicated and hard, but just getting your butt in the seat and going to the church and drinking bad coffee and talking to people, like that's what it's about at the end of the day.
Let's make this anecdotal. This will be fun. So one of our friends, when I was baptized, she said, "Well, now I got to let you guys know that you're living in sin. You're not married." I said, "Oh, yeah, I guess that's true." So she gave, she read us the Riot Act. So Vanessa and I have, in fact, been celibate for several months while we've been getting our everything in order, not living in sin, raising a child. And we're getting married on Wednesday.
Oh, wow. That's awesome. Congrats.
And here's the reason why I wanted to mention that, which is we're trying to figure it out. It's funny. It's like flexing the muscles of the secular world, like using the mind to try to solve this kind of a problem. This is back to the notion of church works. Yeah. We're trying to figure it out. And it's very complicated. Like, wait, geez, you know, should it be kind of X big? And do I need to invite Y people? And how do we do the... And then we noticed we just started having conversations with people in the church, and in particular, one of our neighbors, who I'll keep anonymous because I don't know if she wants to be public. And we just sat down. And I said, "Look, here's the way I feel about this." And we read a bunch of books on Christian marriage and covenant marriage and all these things. I said, "Look, as far as I'm concerned, I don't want to have anything secular in the center of what's happening. So if we accidentally, unconsciously import something that our culture happens to have put into the institution of marriage, I don't want to do that. If it's not about God, then I don't want to be part of it." And then Vanessa happened to have pulled off her wedding ring, which she's been wearing for about a decade, which is my grandfather's. And she noticed inside that it had the inscription of February 14th, 1948. this is about 2 weeks ago. She looks at it, she goes, Valentine's Day, that might be like nice. We might be able to do something. They just kind of like floated around. And then we mentioned it to our friend and said, yeah, but you know, how exactly do we make that work? It's a Wednesday, middle of the week, people are going to come. She goes, no, it's Wednesday. That's house church. Everybody who you want to invite is going to be coming to house church anyway. We'll just have house church at church. We'll do an ordinary devotional, and your ceremony will be part of that. We'll weave it in. And it was just like, yeah, that's very easy. So in a matter of minutes, she put together an invitation, sent it out to the house church list, mentioned that Vanessa didn't have a dress. I didn't have a suit. All of our worldly goods are still sitting in pods in San Diego, by the way, 2 years later. Two guys at the church came who were like roughly are my size and said, here's suits. You want to try that? You know, somebody who had had a wedding dress that Vanessa borrowed, we borrowed a flower girl dress, and it all just sort of came together. All right, so this big, and both of us, by the way, had big, you know, $20,000-$30,000 weddings previously in our lives. We're familiar with kind of like that structure. And the point is that it's not even effortless, but actually help. There's a heart and a synergistic guidance that the people who are around us in the church now feel a shared joy. That they're participating in something. Actually, I've had so many people, as I would say, if it's funny, other people are more like heartened and enjoyed by this than we are, because it's creating such a beautiful opportunity to relearn how this is, should have always been properly done in some sense. And by the way, I'll sort of wave over here to the Catholics and the Eastern Orthodox. And we're not going to be able to participate in the liturgy that are woven into those traditions because we don't know them. And so, which is not to say, by the way, that those aren't wonderful things. I just don't have them. But at the least, something that is very centered in God at the top and the body of the church being what's holding it. And this is not an institution. It's a state institution. This is something that's more fundamental than that. And when you said it rightly, it all like it's so... so beautiful. Like it's, I said the word really beautiful. It's a beautiful, beautiful thing. And so this is my same experience in church. Like church, when it comes together, and our church is alive. So I don't have any experience of what it's like to be in churches that are either just going through the motions or in the process of dying. We're in a church that's in the process of very high vitality and growth. That's where we're putting it. Well, I guess there's two things. One is deeply, disabusing or disillusioning the silly notion that we could try to redesign this sort of thing bespoke. That's not going to do that. that's not going to happen. But also it's there, like that wholesomeness, that connectivity to a lived community and to all the elements that are the binding that hold a lived community together. And again, in relationship to the transcendent, right? In relationship to the eternal, to the divine. And it works. It's beautiful. It's just so solid and so good. It's such a reminder of what beauty, truth, and goodness actually are. That then, comes out to the rest of life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you mentioned a house church. So I think that's probably another term for like small groups and that sort of thing, where this was something that's a major part of the I think most Protestant churches, I'm not sure what's happening on the Catholic and Orthodox side. That was surprising to me, that this idea of like, okay, you're in church. That's one part of it. But now you kind of look for your people to support. And this is kind of like language from my church. This is love on people, right? It's just random people that you're going to connect with. You might be going through the same phases of life. Maybe you're not in the same stage of life, but you're going to get together. You're going to talk about what's happening. And then you're going to talk about this like deeply intimate thing, this faith at the same time. And that's amazing that there's just regular people doing that. All the time, right?
Like, it is, yeah. So it's a kind of news to the world. They're just regular people doing that all the time, and it works. And it's super powerful. Like you, that experience of walking into a house church for the very first time and seeing, a mom holding a kid, and then learning a few minutes later it's not her kid, and then like an 8-year-old girl just comes by, grabs the kid, and then takes the 2-year-old kid out to another place. Like, oh wow, this group is integrated deeply. They're woven together in a very strong way. And then having bad things happen, as they do to humans, and seeing how that strongly woven fabric holds human beings in a very powerful way.
I might jump in. So one thing, part of my journey recently is I've long felt like we shouldn't start things from scratch. We shouldn't try to figure out societies from scratch, because it's just, I've visited enough intentional communities in my 20s to realize when we start from scratch, it's just, there's too many things to try to innovate and hold at once. And then too many random norms that are just like picked and chosen from different cultures and societies and times in history that nobody can really agree. And then it just becomes this like jumbled up mess. So I thought, you know, all right, I'm going to move to like a functional community. This is, you know, in Uruguay, and it was really functional. But I wasn't from there, and it wasn't really my culture. And so then, you know, I moved back to Chicago. That's very recent. Back to my family, back to my culture. We're trying to figure out which church parish to go to. We both grew up in the church, so it's my husband and I. So it's, you know, it's really just about returning back to those normal things. But I think it would be interesting to hear how your thought process went. You said something, I think it was on Jim Rutt. The difference between like trying to like recreate a seed from scratch and all the DNA inside all of that versus just bringing a plant back to life. And I think there also is a cultural thing, like a sociological thing going on, where regular people can't know the answer to life. Like, you know, it has to be recreated by the galaxy brains, and we're all just going to have to, you know, really solve the problems from scratch. And in fact, it's quite utopian, and in many ways, very like chauvinistic to think, well, you know, all of these people and their wisdom and their social technologies through the ages can't know. Only we can know after studying all of these histories and picking and choosing. And so, like, I don't know, that there's a big shift in that humility of normal people. And I bet some of your feedback, if you experience any of it, has something to do with that, I think, underlying idea that like regular people can't be wise in this way. And I just am curious how you are thinking about that now.
Well, one of the things that I suppose I struggle against is, I'm not intentionally part of any scene, let's put it that way. So I've seen circles or diagrams or pictures online of different scenes that are out there that have names.
Yeah.
Often well after I've sort of stopped spending time there, we'll have my name somewhere in the circle. And I'm actually, literally at a theoretical level, I'm opposed to that as a category. My sense is that it always degenerates into something.
Yeah. It's
so rapidly parasitized that it becomes more of a distraction than anything else. So I can't and won't speak for any scenes.
Right.
I can say that for myself, it has been a very long time, and maybe never really, that I've had a sense that, let's say the common person, the salt of the earth, A, has, their wisdom is not valuable, or even B, not central. I was not raised that way. I was raised much more in the opposite direction, which maybe isn't obvious, because of course I spent most of my time speaking in, let's say, with the galaxy brain folks about galaxy brain ideas. But from my point of view, more of the opposite, more of the, okay, there's two or three really important things that are out there that need to be brought in and integrated. So for me, that's largely been how it's been. Now, here's the place where the humility just kicked in heavy. And that was actually God. That's a different part of the story.
Right.
Not so much about the salt of the earth or even about tradition, but about the fact that there's something that human beings that are doing that is held in the context of the infinite. That's different, right? And that's the place where arrogance has its most fundamental location, right? This is literally the Luciferian issue, right? Everything can be actually quite beautifully integrated and look very similar to what God is, you know, the God's plan on this earth. If it's ever so slightly separated, let's say at the top, then it's completely off. And that, I think, is the key. It's that little tiny bit, like the galaxy brain bit, just saying, hey, just one or two pieces. Yeah, but we're going to be the ones who are doing it at the very top, because this God thing is actually just kind of like a mistake, an error, a deception. And everything else is fine. Like, great. Well, you know, whatever it looks like. We're going to integrate indigenous wisdom. We're going to integrate, you know, traditions. But there's going to be kind of like, we're at the top of the hierarchy. That's kind of the key thing. Maybe that's exactly what you're feeling. It's like we're at the top of the hierarchy.
Yeah.
Obviously, because we're thinking the most important things in the most clear way. And these are really hard things to think about. So where else would we be? Can't be anywhere else. And that's the key, is to actually say, no. You're not just not at the top of the hierarchy. You're infinitely far away from the top. And that means suddenly everything changes. It changes everything completely. Now the question is one of, okay, well, how do you fit into God's plan? You know, simple as that. And if it turns out that in God's plan, you're supposed to be solving some very esoteric problem, which is maybe the keystone in an arch, to use kind of like a cathedral metaphor, great. You're the mason who's figuring out how to put the keystone in the arch. But in abject humility, because whatever you're doing, it's infinitesimal in relationship with what God's doing. And I feel like that was the shift for me in a very big way. We can talk about this combination, it's both an intellectual and a deeply personal journey. But
it was interesting to hear Jim Rutt said he expected you to come with like some big intellectual argument, like an egregore that you decided to buy into. And I think that's a big misconception, right? You want to have like ideas at the top of the stack where it's like, no, I really believe there is a real God and he really cares about me. Right. Yes. And all the stupid right. stuff I do and what's in my heart. And I'm going to, what if that's true? How am I really going to act? Mm. Right. If I really believe there's a real God that believes about me, like that changes, that should change everything about your life. Right. And it's not just an idea. And when I started looking at the Bible, that was a huge thing. I thought I would read it and I'd just kind of get smarter and I'd get some lessons and I could kind of take what I wanted and engage with an idea. But yeah. It's not that.
No, it's beautiful, isn't it? Yeah, exactly. Like one of the things that I've noticed now, because of now that I'm in some sense, well, I guess fundamentally on the other side, and then learning how to do that better and better, is witnessing that, noticing that, and going, oh man, you're looking at it exactly the wrong way. Like this isn't the kind of thing where you read a line, you read a section of the Bible, and you're like, okay, I'm going to take from it what I want to take from it, and I'm going to make it fit. Like, no. You have to come at it from the opposite direction, which is maybe I don't understand. In fact, certainly I don't understand what's going on here. And I'm going to sit with it and listen to it, maybe interact with people who've been sitting with it for a lot longer than me, and recognize, by the way, that almost all of it's going to be in a mystery that I'll never grasp. But nonetheless, the piece that does land on me is gold, solid gold, that can move me forward in a way that I could never have done on my own.
Have you had the experience of kind of noticing religious thinking now that you're kind of actually, once you buy in and you start thinking religiously, are you seeing that out in the various tribes you interact with? Right. The AI world is definitely one that comes to mind.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And again, this notion of like the secular endeavoring to create a simulacrum, because it actually is necessary. There's no way around it. And so it creates these fabrications that are pale copies of the real thing, because at the end of the day, they are actually, you know, worshiping almost, maybe almost universally mind or technology. You know, it is some kind of egregore up there.
Yeah, like an egregore is going to own you, right? So choose which one.
Yeah, you're going to be worshiping something. And the question is, this is actually a conversation I was having in the context of spiritual but not religious. Mm-hmm. And because, you know, that's a whole category, and the process is something like, okay, if you're spiritual but not religious, you've come to the point of recognizing the notion of spiritual is a real thing. You're no longer kind of worried about that, and now you're doing something like liturgy. You can't help but, when I say liturgy, by the way, I would like to make sure that's really deeply like in the world. That's a very powerful concept, and it's sadly understood as far as I can tell. And this notion of liturgy is the work we do together to ravel us together into communion, liturgy. And I said, look, you know, people who engage in liturgy ubiquitously, like we just had a big one called the Super Bowl. People are coming into communion with each other and having this relationship of moving from multiplicity into unity, becoming part of a being that is larger than themselves. I wouldn't say that's a great one. Like, I don't. Suddenly, I'm not watching the Super Bowl at all. And in fact, I'm like, wow, that's a very terrible idea. Don't do that. Don't participate in that liturgy. It's actually an anti-liturgy. It takes you further away. So the question then for the spiritual non-religious is, what communion? With whom are you entering into communion? What spirits are you actually under worshiping? Because that might be a very dangerous spirit you're worshiping. You may actually be inadvertently bringing yourself into service of something that isn't a good thing. And so this is where religion, let's say, properly comes in, or in fact, specifically where Christ comes in. how do we actually create that sense of faith, right? The sense of well-grounded confidence that we are able to come into communion properly, like the right communion with the right being. Well, that's this, right? That's the question. It's like the big question. If you're in that spiritual, not religious, I propose if you examine that question very, very deeply and recognize that the consequences are as profound as anything could be, that you will need to move into a different location than spiritual, not religious, because that question is the question that is central to the question of religion, I would say.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious, when I was listening to Jim, and I love Jim, so now he's kind of being held up as a straw man in this conversation, but, you know, Jim, I love you if you're listening to this. Okay, so I'm curious, though, I think that there's probably like an approach to knowing that's characteristic in rational thinking that has to do with like, this is the answer as far as we know up until this point. Like, you know, we have a certain data set and, you know, the human mind is so amazing and science is so amazing and we have an answer and this is definitive, at least up until as much as we know at the moment. And I heard some tension in your conversation with Jim, which was like, you know, do you actually believe these things? And it seemed like your answer was sort of like, the answer is unfolding in mystery through the rest of my life. And I think that there's something really interesting in that, like, a kind of approach to knowing entirely. I mean, anyone who's lived long enough kind of like, realizes there's just so much nuance in life. And, you know, when you're young, you're just so, you know, you just think you know everything and you think the answers are so clear. And then as life goes on, you realize you know what you don't know what you don't know. And I'm just wondering, yeah, I guess just like this approach to embracing mystery, unfolding, nuance, constant lessons. And like you were saying, reading a story when you're 16 versus when you're 60. You know, maybe you read it at 16 and you think, oh, I really got that. And then at 60, you realize there was a lot more going on here than I thought.
Yeah, I think you hit on a very particular thing. It's like a different relationship. It's funny, that's pretty recursive, isn't it? A different relationship to the difference between belief / knowing, understanding, thinking, ideas, and relationship. So the point here is that what happens in this transition, and this is now specifically Christianity, not necessarily religion, qua religion, is that relationship is recentered to its proper location at the center. So it begins, it's like the Copernican Revolution returned back. Relationship is at the center. And then from there, it creates a process whereby you can come into understanding, whereby you can have something like beliefs or ideas that are all the way at the very end of that and kind of sitting there at the end, like, okay. Because of course, beliefs are context specific. What I mean is, I'm gonna say this right. Things that I can say in words about very particular events, like, okay, you know, do I believe that the man should be the head of the family?
Right.
Belief all in that. Well, I mean, the answer is something like, well, which man, which family? Like,
right.
At the principled level, I can talk about an architecture that comes from an archetypal transcendent location that presents down something that can allow us to move ourselves in a direction of greater and greater strength and greater good and depth. But that is a very big, heavy, strong thing that requires tremendous amounts of time and energy and effort to come into relationship with that. Mm-hmm. From it, you can then begin to start pointing to particulars and say, well, what this really means is, I'll give you like a very clean example. Like when we stepped across this, yeah, this is what we're going to be doing. What happens like within 2 days? Vanessa sits me down and she says, I need you to step up. You're actually not upholding your responsibility as a man in this relationship. Like, you're right. And she's like, you know, okay, you're right. That's the consequence, right? So it actually speaks more towards how do you behave? How do you live And in the hierarchy of what's the most meaningful, right? How do you live in the parts that are the most meaningful, the most important? And then, you know, let that kind of, so these edge cases out here, the intellectual mind spends a lot of time engaging in thought experiments around edge cases. It's kind of the whole the trolley problem. Yeah, that's not how reality works. Reality doesn't work by virtue of thinking through thought experiments. Reality works by actually living life directly. Mm-hmm. And you're going to do what you're going to do depending on who you are in that moment. And so, you know, build character, become a person that is able to make wise choices in the context of intense experiences. And then, by the way, I'm thinking trolley problem right now. And then it'll play out the way that it plays out. You know, God help you. So that shift, like centering relationship at the center. And by the way, now centering relationality, which is to say the triune God at the center of that center, is profound. I can't even really say anything more than that. It is shattering utterly. And anything, the ideology, mind, ideas, words, theories shatter utterly on that, and then can be reformed in a new way from that location.
I'll just say, I want to throw back to Tim, but this question specifically about, you know, do you believe that the male should be the head of the household and the woman should, you know, obey? I think, like, to the rational, modern, progressive mind, like, this is so chauvinistic. You know, we've solved this problem. It's in the past. Women should be complete equals. But then how does that work in practice has had so many cascading failures that, like, even from a pro-woman perspective, speaking as a woman, this is something, like, I think a lot of women now are grappling with. Maybe the differences between men and women and this idea of man as, you know, head of household, and there's an authority there, which then takes a certain kind of responsibility off the plate of the woman that then makes the family function better. Is actually a great social technology. I'm talking as a sociologist now. And so, like, just thinking about how that would work in practice in a way that's differentiates men and women for mutual thriving and for the thriving of the family, I think is actually just it's an underexplored topic. I think some people are talking about it, but that's just one of the things that sort of comes from this wise traditional religious thinking that in relationship could lead to sort of more widespread thriving, but is sort of off the table to talk about in certain circles, I guess. Tim, sorry, you can go ahead.
That's off the table, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, the different, I think the different, like, psychotechnologies is an interesting way to look at it, right? Like, we were talking about the youth part. And one thing I've noticed with, you know, Jordan, you were saying you noticed teenagers coming to church, right? I'm noticing the same thing. And, you know, the town I'm in is about 4,000 people, right? It's about half the size of the town you're in. But our little Methodist church, that's the place to be every Wednesday night in the country. There's a youth group there. They're meeting for 2 hours. They're having fun together. Every kid, whether or not they're Christian or not, is wanting to be there because it's kind of this new third place where there's no parents watching them. It's not structured sports. And that's been quite fascinating watching these kids kind of come into it. And I noticed for my daughter, it was just interesting to watch. Like, you could tell that she's 14, and, you know, we're typical Gen X folks. We never said religion was bad. We never said it was good. Let your kid figure it out, sort of thing. But you could tell she just loved to know that there was right and wrong. Like, that was, they needed that. And she liked to hear that there was a right and there was a wrong, right? There's the modernity kind of puts this thing on us where, like, you've got whatever is right for you is what's right, but that's a lot of pressure, right?
Well, it's in fact impossible. So it's actually quite cruel because certainly not a 14-year-old, but not even a mature adult who's lived a profound life is still not going to be able to match that level of responsibility. I actually had the encounter recently where in our town, we were having some conversations about what kinds of things would be good. And one of the questions was the third place for teenagers. Mm-hmm. And as we were talking about it, I was noticing that all the suggestions that were coming out of more of a secular perspective were sort of fraught with failure from the early, either because the things they were beginning to curate in, like, trying to think of an example, gosh, I can't remember the examples of, but it's like as you're, if you kind of look at it, like, oh man, yeah, you know, I can imagine where in 1970 this made sense. It seemed like it would make sense because it would be fun. It's because we can't actually think about the complexity of the anthropological problem of putting a bunch of adolescents in this context, not, you know, manage and govern. So what happens? First, we have the experience of the 60s and the 70s and the 80s, where that melts down into the inevitable, Lord of the Flies dynamic. And what happens when you put a bunch of adolescents in a set where right and wrong and good and bad aren't at the center of it?
Yeah.
So then we get into the 90s and the 2000s, like, oh, that didn't work. So now we're going to have hall monitors on every activity they engage in, which also totally doesn't work. Like, no, let's take a whole step back. If like the context itself is wholesome intrinsically, and there's already a completely understood structure of what right and wrong, the right and wrong are and what they are, and you're part of that, then that, you know, that's the context that allows these things to be held. So it creates freedom, right? It actually creates freedom to be held in that kind of a structure. There was something that was up that I want. I would like to take this moment to disambiguate a few things, because I know this is a conjecture about what is the church that I'm part of. And I think it's a really beautiful story. So the way that I think about it is that we're definitely not Catholic or Orthodox, because they have a substantial amount of stuff, institutional infrastructure, and I's to dot and T's to cross that we don't have. So we're definitely the Protestant category. But it's a COVID church. What happened was, when COVID came and all the churches were shut down, a group of people, roughly about 60, although not at the same place, said, screw that, I'm still going to church. So they just rolled it over into house church. They started getting together in each other's houses. But this necessitated a mixture of, they didn't all originally go to the same church or the same denomination. So it was an admixture of a denominational groups in an intimate setting of home. Right? So it wasn't an ecumenical kind of top-down theoretic concept of multi, what's it called, non-denominational church. It was in fact highly denominational, but mixed together in an intimate setting of home. And as it just maybe sort of turns out, depending on your preference of how specifically the Lord is moving in the space, which I suspect is actually quite substantially, a super saturation of people who have deep backgrounds in theology. So a lot of people either had spent time as pastors or in ministry or missions and things like that. And so the theological conversations were and continue to be quite rich. And so I'm right now reading For the Life of the World, almost done with it, by Schimmelman. And it's beautiful. And it was recommended to me by one of the several pastors we have in this 150-person church. He's an Orthodox theologian. And so we cut across a huge swath of the things that have happened in the category of Christendom. And I think in many cases, the real depth of understanding of big pieces, and certainly an honoring, a deep honoring of the beauty that has come through all the different traditions, and are endeavoring to find ways to live. So the centerpiece is much less about the statement of belief, for example. It's very, you know, Jim did a very odd and interesting thing when he grabbed that, which I think is actually, by the way, I didn't have any trouble with it. I felt fine. But many people have commented that they didn't like it. but it is what it is. But what's the phrase? One of the phrases that came out of the churches, that the hermeneutics of presence. Is this a common currency term? I'd never heard of it before, but I think it's not. The notion of hermeneutics is sort of the process whereby you would interpret a text, for example. So particularly if you're Protestant, it's very important. Like, okay, how are we going to interpret the Bible? Like, what's our hermeneutics? And ours is the hermeneutics of presence, meaning it's not the methodology of the making sense of the words that are on the page as much as it is the presence of God. And we're actually working to be in presence, and finding ways to be in presence, and from that location that other things can happen, which is where this concept of relationship is more fundamental. The opposite of ideology came from. And I was actually having a conversation with our pastor, and I was like, "That's something that I want to think about."
That relationship you mentioned, kind of the how do you have a personal relationship with Jesus, right? That seems to be it. That was for Jim. I could tell that was just like what does that even mean?
Yeah. Well, it's funny because when I think about the way he's thought about it, he refers to Yahweh.
Yep.
And then he refers to Jesus, and he doesn't seem to have any notion that they're the same in the context.
Yeah, there's a, it's a continuation, right? That
And that, I was like, no, that's the Trinity, the triune God, and there's the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. And you can map Yahweh to the Father if you'd like, although it's not actually a perfect map. But there's some decent thing there. Like, that's a theological distinction that, frankly, has kind of been thrown away by modernity. Mm-hmm. And then reified, the modernity, the modern mind comes back in and finds a bunch of gaps in a theology that's actually not even the theology that we're operating with.
Yeah, it's a lot more complex than you'd think, right? Like the main story that's out in the culture right now is not a great one. It's not a strong one about Christianity.
Yeah. Much more complex, much more subtle, much more, frankly, much more connected with philosophy. Obviously, the Cappadocian fathers were hanging out with the Neoplatonists at exactly the same moment, and they were they're communicating quite deeply, right? So the tradition is rich, like super rich, beyond comprehension rich. And the pale and very silly version of it that is left over is that, which is kind of the dust in the modern mind. Don't kind of tilt at that window.
Yeah.
About it. Don't, that's a waste of your time. Like, if you, I can debunk. Yeah, of course you can debunk this because it's stupid. If you shift over here and you're like, wow, that's actually a very rich, incredibly intense tradition, and I'll honor it directly, you'll start making real progress.
Yep. So I wanted to talk to you about kind of where you think the future of this movement is happening, right? Like, you're not the first kind of public intellectual that has converted recently. And then there seems to be something in the air. I know you've been thinking a lot about just kind of what's happening now with the digital, like what's the phase shift that we're in all of a sudden, and is it much bigger than people recognize? Any prediction on what's going to be, what's happening with what will be happening with the Christian movement?
Yeah, well, in a conversation with John Verveke and Rick Henriquez, I coined the term practical eschatology. Mm-hmm. So I'm a practical eschatologist. So yes, I do have a prediction. This mirrors to the doomer optimism side of things quite beautifully, actually. So nothing has changed in terms of my perspective that the assessment of the old fashioned way of languaging, the game A, game B transition, is very much at hand.
Yeah.
That the explosion of the digital in all the different aspects is continuing to unfold as foretold. And that the modern mind, to say the very least, is not vaguely equipped to handle the consequences of that at the psychological, ultimately then to the spiritual, or at the sociological and cultural level. And the unraveling of all the different characteristics of the modern world, the institutional structures, which now, 90% of Americans recognize that effectively all institutions are utterly corrupt. And I mean corrupt not in the sense of completely captured, but both completely captured and completely ineffective and malignant in behavior. And this is true of all global institutions. So the end of the institutional era is at hand. The context in which we are moving into is novel and singular in history. And this digital wave is exploding outwards at a light speed and consuming everything. Okay, so all of that is still, as far as I can tell, not just true, but increasingly confirmed by evidence. And so the squeeze is going to continue. The squeeze on trying to stay in the old ain't going to work. The old is definitely going away. And okay, what does it look like to move into something that is vaguely responsive to the world we're in? Now, this is the shift. The shift of, I will say, first person is somebody who's been very deeply involved in the investigation of that transition, that first you're going to move from the atheistic into something like the open secular. Then you're going to move from that into the spiritual. Then you're going to move from that into the religious. And then you're going to move from that into Christianity.
Okay, so I actually have I would like for you to talk through how you're thinking, why Christianity and not Buddhism or any other religion. I think for a lot of people, they move from spirituality into Buddhist meditation, and it's just there is, I think you said it in the Emerge interview, people are just highly allergic to Christianity. They'll go into any religion and try to start taking all of that on before looking into their own, the religion that's basically tied up with the whole West.
Yeah,
curious, make the case. Why Christianity specifically?
Well, let's start with where we just, the last part. So let's talk about the allergen piece, because it's very, I think it's important. Certainly I experienced it. Tim, did you experience that sense of allergen?
Oh, yeah. 100%. I grew up in a little Protestant or a Pentecostal church that was a little bit strange. You know, it was a highly integrated church, like half black, half white. And there's dancing in the aisle, speaking in tongues, all that. And it was just strange to me. And then, you know, I had the Jim Rudd epiphany at 11 where I said, this all can't be true. Right. I'm like, well, if I was born in India, I believe that. Right. It's the last thing you want to go back and look at. Right.
Yeah, exactly. So I also had a very strong aversion, like actual aversion to Christianity and all of its various artifacts. And I also, like many people, as I moved down this path, I never spent any time in the atheistic kind of pole, because it's silly, but plenty of time in the agnostic pole and the secular the secular physicalist agnostic pole. And as you cross that threshold into spirituality, the aversion that so many of us are living with. And by the way, the institutional Christianity in the United States and I guess in Europe didn't do a lot of favors. There's a lot of, improper doctrine that people think is what Christianity is. And so they properly are averse to that because it's actually not right. It's a mistake or an error. It's an error. It's a reaction, most specifically. So then you're like, okay, now what? So you start looking around. And in the 60s, 50s and 60s, this Eastern stuff was novel. It was a novelty. It was new. And of course, our Westerns love new stuff just because it's new. Neophilic. And so we started exploring that. And there's two ways of talking about it from my point of view. One is the experience you had of Uruguay, in which I had both Ecuador and Kauai. Well, that's not my place.
Yeah.
And maybe if I were Japanese or Chinese or more Thai, maybe it'd probably be proper for me to sort of orient in that direction, but I'm not, which means, just a very simple way of putting it, I'm not immersed in a context where all the different characteristics of it are fully super saturated in the environment that I'm in. You can't abstract a religion from its lived context and then pretend that you're living it. That ain't going to work.
No, that's so true.
It's not how it works, but it actually is the whole lived context. You have to have all of those elements for it to be a vital thing. What you've done is you've just done the cut flower thing again. Like that C.S. Lewis, cut flowers. If you take, Hinduism, or you take Buddhism and you cut the flower and you migrate it over and kind of like stick it in a vase in New York City, you look kind of pretty for a little while and then you look real sad because it's dead, because it's not alive anymore.
Right.
Okay. What does it look like to be plugging in? So first of all, let's just, if you're going to plug into a religion, plug into a religion that is alive, or at least can be alive. This is that kind of like seed versus plant. So Christianity in the West, Christianity in America is a sadly drooping plant. We're going to need to change out the soil, this root bound, move it into, get it out of a pot. Why has it been in a pot all this time? Let's put it back in the earth. I love that, that reconnecting with nature, that's the metaphor. Then we need to water it. Right? We need to give it proper sunlight. We need to kind of get the weeds out of there. So it's a care and feeding, though, but of a thing that is naturally part of an ecosystem. How funny, like, all the metaphors. That can then grow back into that ecology. So that's at a theoretic level, that's the right way of engaging in this kind of thing. And so that starts making some distinctions. Now, if you're going to be, if you are Japanese, then maybe Zen Buddhism is for you, at least in this immediate term. Okay, now the second is much deeper. I don't want to put a lot of stake on it because, again, I'm very new here. But as I have, in fact, spent time engaging with the world's religions, which I have, Christianity was the last, not the first. My intimacy with those religions is not super deep, so I don't want to speak too much out of turn. But as far as I can tell, Christianity, and in particular, the characteristics of the Trinity, are in fact more correct.
Work
in all the characteristics that you would need to get into. So that ends up being a bit of a tough pill, because now I'm saying, hey guys, if you do Buddhism, you're going to go somewhere, but you're not going to go all the way. And if you want to go all the way, you're going to have to come over here and interact with the Trinity, with the Triune God, and that's a different kind of thing. It invites different responsibilities or requirements. And that's maybe a big, beautiful conversation. I don't think it's a conversation we need to have right now, because what we need to have right now is, let's get those who are, let's get the lived context alive, and let that aliveness, in many ways, just speak for itself. Like, that's the way of doing it. I'm happy to have an intellectual conversation about the Trinity with somebody who wants to have it. But the real answer is let's breathe life back into this and then live it fully and become disciples of Christ.
Yeah, that discipleship is a big call, right? I mean, that's what Christ calls us to do. So how do you see that kind of playing out in your projects, right? So you've got big intellectual projects. You've been thinking about them deeply for a long time. And now I imagine like the color of them is must change on some level as you change. So do you see it as just an extension or?
No. What it does is it's an inversion or a flipping. Our sermon list last Sunday was quite beautiful. It was amazing. And as I'm sitting there, I'm noticing, okay, as I'm listening, and the call here, by the way, so discipleship connects also to the kingdom. So we're very much oriented towards, hey, the kingdom of heaven is at hand, which means that we have both an invitation, a possibility, and a responsibility by means of discipleship to actually bring more and more of the kingdom to earth, as it is in heaven. And so my journey has brought me some capabilities, some skills, some actually hard work learned insights that I can gift to my community in service of that larger project. And this is very practical. Like, it's a very practical thing. It's not that different than, say, somebody else who's sitting over there who's a carpenter, and his skills can be gifted into that project. And now the question is, okay, so how do I help? It's more like that.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And be and gift most cleanly and fully as I can. It's funny, we were just right before this call, we were at a meeting with a youth home ministry that we're volunteering. Mm-hmm. And the question is, well, maybe right now what I'm doing, by the way, is making the coffee better. I'm acting as a barista at the cafe. It has nothing to do with any of these theoretical things I've been working. Although in some sense it completely does, right? Because I can now sit with the other people in the cafe and talk about vocation. And talk about the importance and power of actually feeling like, one, humility, that what you're doing, if it's in service, is the most meaningful thing you can do. But then two, finding your proper calling and being able to give that calling into a lived context is the thing you should be doing, given individual. And then it becomes very powerful, because now if your calling is to be the barista at this cafe, and to pray over the coffee and to hold the devotional relationship with the fact that you're giving people coffee to support their good work, then you're in exactly the right place. There's no need to feel anything other than grace and glory in that context. And that's something I can feel very comfortable saying. Like, I've looked at this thing. I've been at the top of a variety of mountaintops. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you that they hold nothing. So don't worry about it. You may have to struggle with it, but I can tell you, if you'd like to listen to other people's stories and learn from them instead of climbing your own mountains, I can tell you these six mountains that I've climbed, not much to them. They're not really worth climbing other than maybe exercise. But the mountain right here, the one that you're looking at and the journey you're on, I'm on there now with you, next to you. Yeah. And if you take that as encouragement, then I'm happy to give you courage in that direction. So it kind of starts going in that direction, which is
it's nice. Amazing that idea of transformation, right? So like Jesus calls you to die to the world and live for him. And the way that can hit each individual, whether no matter what your calling is just amazing. Like the way that you could be aligned for something good and true, while also just really individuate is one of the coolest things that I've. Like I was looking everywhere for that, right? I'm reading Jung and I'm like, wow, geez, how do I get in touch with my shadow and individuate and become a real 3D human being? And turns out there's just a simple little book and a God that was there the whole time that calls you to this huge thing that I think makes Christianity just like amazing and unique and alive.
So I want to reinforce, just so beautiful. If you're interacting with it and you're not perceiving the beauty, then I would say that you're not perceiving it yet.
Yeah, Elizabeth Oldfeld, she talks about full strength Christianity, like the mystic part, the beautiful part. And I think you see that. I mean, when I was first thinking, okay, I might become a Christian, No, I wanted to become an Orthodox because, you know, that's like the hip, most hipster.
But it's so beautiful, like, and the and the
yeah,
service,
right, you know, and there's this whole connection that
rituals, yeah.
you know, so I was happy to see I notched one down for the Protestant team. So, oh, Jordan didn't become you might have an Orthodox beard, but not
but by the way, I'm shaving it, so this will come out after. I decided to make it a Vanessa asked me to shave it. I said, well, I want to wear it to church so that when I show up at the wedding completely shaved, it'll be, we'll have a
only.
So, okay. So similarly to both of you with religion, I feel this way both about religion, but I'm also sort of extending this line of thinking to many different aspects of the community I grew up in that I now move back to. And I'm just curious, both of your thoughts, just a little bit of background. In my neighborhood, it's like an Irish Catholic neighborhood in Chicago. And so like church is still really well attended. It's very normal as a part of daily life for families to go to church, to send their kids to Catholic school, or if they don't send their kids to Catholic school, then they send them to, you know, religious education. And everybody in the whole community, I mean, the vast majority go through communion together and confirmation. Weddings are all in these churches. And so returning to that feels like very normal, you know, like everyone that, you know, we're the weird ones for not having done that for our kids already. We're just coming back and, you know, sort of joining back up with the crowd. And I feel the same way kind of about like civic duty. My kids are going to school and I'm starting to like get involved in their school and figure out what's going on with that institution. And like, I just have this like overall fire for like, you know, I think I was very hubristic in thinking like I was better than all of these institutions, and instead that I should use my big brain to go somewhere else and to like come up with some new institution or some new idea. And all these people like, you know, ask me about, you know, move to Uruguay, how can I move to Uruguay like you did and all this stuff. And now I'm like, it's so weird. I think probably weird for you, Jordan, too, like to talk about these things that seem now diametrically opposed to how you think now, and how to like explain that, you know, reversion and thinking, or I don't know if it's reversion or right word. But I feel a real responsibility now that that the work is really just duty and humility, being reliable and showing up and using my attention. And I think you were talking about this in one of the podcasts, Jordan. Attention is finite, and attention is a huge resource. And just thinking about all these people who are otherwise attending to and spending so much time seeking and attending to some things that I think are in fact sort of dead ends and utopian, and instead just thinking about, I don't know, you know, a call to show up. To show up in relationship community, to make sure that all of those things that have been evolving through time don't wither away, you know, and that they not just don't wither, but also evolve in the right direction. Like you want to prune the right weeds, or you want to take out the right, you want to cultivate it. It's like a garden. And so, but the cultivation takes concerted attention, effort, time, showing up regularly. And I just feel that way, you know, not just about going to church and raising my kids, you know, back in the church and giving them that, but also all the rest of it.
Yeah, well, it's that notion that lived context. So, from my point of view, if we conceptualize, or if we think of the notion of church as being an institution that sits next to other institutions, we're actually thinking about it wrong. That it's more like a field. Because of course it holds the body of the people, right? And so it's actually operating at the level of the people, not at the level of an institution.
Right.
And that's what provides the ligature or the communion that allows that group of people to come together and to be a community, to have a beingness to them, out of which they can then construct various institutions. And that puts things in the right order. Because if you have institutions separated from communion, then the institutions become idols, right? We end up, and then they go down these natural degradation paths. And what I was thinking in my mind is, for example, let's say take school or education as an example. So as a heuristic, I will still be very skeptical of two things. One, institutions that are not that old, like public education in the United States is only about 100, 150
years. Yeah.
It does not get the nod of deference from me, not at all.
Not Lindy.
No, it's not Lindy. Lindy. Yeah, exactly. Now we went and visited a classical education, essentially instituting the trivium, and that's a lot older. It's like, okay, I'll give that a lot more deference. But here's the thing. What we've discovered is that, you might imagine, our community actually has a very large homeschooling group. And homeschooling is a lot older than that, right? Parents and groups of parents, the homeschooling collectives, like groups of parents coming together to support each other in co-raising their children and nurturing their children together. It's like the oldest thing. That's the oldest thing. And of course, in this context, it's also very connected to church, although it's not the same church. Many different people from different churches are mixing in the homeschooling collective. And so to that, I will pay the deepest deference. And so it's almost like things that are most grounded and most connected with church. Let's just say, and that here at church, where I mean is like the body. At that point, I have to step back and say, okay, this is above me and beyond me. So allow, I'll be now listening for the Lord to give me guidance of how to be in relationship with it. Mm-hmm. So it's funny because you said like this sort of this role that I kind of maybe I'm sitting in, where I'm sitting between two worlds.
Mm-hmm.
In many cases, what I can do is I can provide the coup de grace critique of the dying secular institutions, so that most people no longer have to trouble themselves with them anymore. And so if you feel concerned about sending your kid to public school, I'm happy to shoot it in the head for you so you can move on with your life. And then, okay, where do you go next? Well, okay, if you find yourself in a context where you can begin to, if you're part of a church, it's a healthy, vital, lived church and it's working. And in that context, you're finding homeschooling groups that are coming together. Beautiful. Well, maybe that's the plant. This is that weeding piece. How do we pull out the weeds that have sucked the life out of this? Because education should actually be part of a commons. And it should not be a state thing. And it should not be a market thing. It should be a commons thing. Like family and church. Right? I remember that. Do you remember those conversations? Like, this is where originally it's not a religion. The birth for me is rediscovery of the commons as a fundamental in how human beings operate. And we live in this world where we've sort of killed the commons and everything's either the state or the market.
Mm-hmm.
Commons is more fundamental and all the important things properly live there. So, okay, well, how do we weed things and how do we water things and how do we reconnect things into a proper ecology? And it's funny because I was like in my mind to kind of visualizing the evolution of the what may in fact be the public school in your community. But of course, if you go back in time long enough, it was actually more like a one-room schoolhouse sensibility because actually connected to a community context.
Mm-hmm.
And the community was alive. And so it wasn't an institution with its own political vertical that was in some sense maybe even opposed to the community context or was needed to be governed by the community in some kind of top-down way, but it was an alive piece of the actual vital ecosystem. And then at the end of the day, it's just a building and some resources to help support something, but the community was alive in it. So that's sort of my sense of it is if the community is, if the church is connected and God is in the center and then the community is held together by that communion, and then the community is watered and the ecosystem of the community is alive, then all the other functions start to come into proper alignment. And we can maybe move things that have been pulled way out here into the secular world back into this alive space, and they can be brought back into their proper location.
Mm-hmm.
Or if necessary, those will just go away and something will be born here because the people, at the end of the day, it's just the people. The people can re-cohere these structures from the bottom up. Not reinventing as much as reawakening.
And I hear like human scale stuff happening here all the time, right? Actually, like it feels good. You can go and be a part of a group that you're actually in. And Jordan, you talked about your experience in a small town, right? Like somebody invited you to a potluck. Someone invited you over to a party, right? Has this been your first small town experience?
Well, weirdly enough, I grew up, well, that's not quite right. When I was in sixth grade, we moved to a small town.
Mm-hmm.
But it was not alive anymore. It had already kind of moved past a point of being a truly alive small town. This is definitely my first experience of being in a live small town. And what I mean by that, for example, is like almost all of the public infrastructure is taken care of by the Committee of Neighborhood Beautification. It's totally not at all connected with the city qua city. and it's effectively all grandmothers.
Yep.
It's exactly the right group of people to be taking care of that. And that's in a live context. And when Vanessa shows up, she hears about it, she is invited to join, and she's brought into it in a beautiful way. Mm-hmm. And now has a piece of responsibility that she's being nurtured into how to take care of properly, which is like right here. But you know, the notion of how do we do our local school? Like, how are we going to, you know, school our child? The answer is we're going to talk to our neighbors.
Yeah.
We're going to talk to people in our church. And then when the right thing shows up, it's like, yeah, let's try that. Let's do that. And it's, maybe it's 12 people. And those 12 people kind of begin doing something. And another group over here is doing something. And it grows from the bottom up in a very organic way, just like our wedding. It's very simple.
Yeah, I like that. You know, there's something also that's really freeing about, I think for a while I was sort of thinking like, oh my gosh, for every life decision, you're having to think about everything from scratch. And it's exhausting. Mm-hmm. Like, it's exhausting to try to think, you know, well, maybe what did like ancient Hindus do? And it's like, what, you don't need to pick and choose from every civilization of all of human history. Like, sometimes yes. It's nice to just ask your neighbors, how is it done? And then just do that. And it's kind of nice. And so I will say, like, you know, public school, at least in my context, is the main thing people do. And so for me, re-engaging with the commons is the public school, you know, it's getting involved with that. And it's like the place where my agency like has a real forcing function, has like a real ability to make a difference. And I think highlight the best parts of that institution, flawed as it is, cities flawed as they are. This is where I'm from. This is where my people are. And what to do and how to engage in the commons in that situation is using the muscle of civil society and the norms of moms to force the institution to work for you. And that is a kind of like, you know, it's a kind of local politics, but it's not necessarily asking the state to be a certain way, but instead infusing like the state institution with the breadth of, you know, civil society norms and interest and agency. I'm curious, why not Asheville? I know Jason Snyder has had his critiques of the Asheville set. He came into some, a couple of different situations where it felt like there was like a, I don't know, Asheville gentrifier versus everybody else in Appalachia kind of dichotomy happening. And so I'm just curious, like, did you see anything like that?
Oh, we spent some time in Asheville. We explored, we originally came to Asheville. We did not come to Black Mountain. My basic analysis of Asheville is that a late stage collapse is sort of playing itself out in public. You know, so you've got kind of the woke psychotic break that's playing itself out. You've got the effort to control and constrain complexity by means of ideology is playing itself out. You have the kind of the crash of different sensibilities, as you say, the gentrification is playing itself out. And it's a lot, like it's a heavy thing, like it's way beyond human scale. Like if you could take Asheville, begin to break it down into sort of 5,000 to 6,000 person groups, which I think is maybe where we'll end up going, then that becomes much more manageable. Like the things you're talking about, you can't steer something that, and it's only what, 80 to 120,000 people, that's still way beyond human scale. And it's far gone. Like it's very wayward. And so, stuff's just gonna have to play itself out, and I'm not. It's not mine to sort of be in there because it's not my place. It's not my people.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't mean that in a sort of a mean way. I mean literally, like, go there. I'm like, yeah, not me.
Yep.
20 minutes down the road in Black Mountain, the very distinct felt sense was, wow, this is my place. This is my people. I'm welcomed here, and by the place, like literally the physical, the trees. Like a tree says, hey, welcome. Come on, hang out in your spot. And of course the people as well. And so then, and it's human scale and it's mostly right. It's like 92% right. So it's not a lot. You're not lifting a whole lot. You're lifting just enough. and very much able to participate in something that's already moving very positively in the right direction. And there's an invitation to come in humility. You know, here's a place you can give your gifts and you can help. And by the way, you're not being asked to do a whole lot, right? Today for the next month, just make the coffee better. and that'll be great.
Yeah, that small town scale, I think, is something special, right? Like this fall at the, you know, I'm out here in Michigan in the Midwest, so everybody's going to the football games on Friday nights. And I drop my daughter off to walk around the track like middle schoolers do. And before she gets home, I got three texts of which boy asked for her phone number, who she's hanging out with. Like, that's amazing to be in relation with that, right? Like,
we're not having kind of the, we call it demographic collapse problem out here in the small town environment.
Yep. Yeah. You were saying vitality with the young people. And one thing that I've found in so much of the, let's just say, you know, professional managerial class, and the spirituality of the professional urban elite is, it's just, there's not really a lot of room for children and families. And like that push for vitality, there's this, almost like a disgust of nature and reproduction and, you know, all of the things that it takes to, you know, literally reproduce yourself as a civilization, which is to have children, are kind of, you know, held at arm's length.
Well, and this is, I think, you know, there's some folks out there who have made the argument there's effectively two terminal points. There's the transhumanist terminal point, which exits biology entirely.
Yeah.
It has to exit it by entirely, because as you say, you basically have two ways of reproducing things. You either reproduce them mechanically, you reproduce them biologically. And if you're on a path where the biologic is collapsing, then the only available thing you could do is try to do it mechanically. And that's either going to be in, you know, artificial wombs, or more likely just upgraded, uploaded minds, which is terrible. When this is very, very bad. Don't go down that path.
If you're literal on that, hell, yeah.
Repent and sin no more. Yeah, literal hell. It is specifically the actual thing that's being talked about. That is actually what hell is. And then the other side, right? And the other side is, well, we're going to have to really repair a lot of stuff. We need to revalorize this notion of motherhood and centralize it. It's so beautiful. When I was walking behind one of our local teenagers, where she was going to pick up her kid at school, and Vanessa and I are walking, and she's pushing a cart, and she's just so insanely cute in this thing. But she's basically wants to be a mom. And it's okay. Like, this is very beautiful. Be a mom, have a bunch of kids, you know, go forth and multiply, and be supported by a community where that's both valorous, even more than valorous, like it's a deeply valued thing, and where it can actually be done. You can actually live, and it's okay. It's not hard. I mean, it's hard, but it's not like impossible. So yes, I actually am, again, back to this notion of like, let's just, you can shoot it in the head and not be bothered with it anymore. The secular cosmopolitan urban world is terminal. It was always going to be terminal. This phrase, inexorably self-terminating, it is inexorably self-terminating. The only question is, do you try to squeeze more years of Kronos into it in the form of an increasingly cybernetic hellscape, or do you actually just repent and step away from it? It has no future, but it may have a really terrible moment of time in front of it.
Have you at all examined or re-examined maybe some of your past technophilia? As in, you know, I don't know if I'm accurately describing, but, you know, at least learning about and being open to any new technology, you know, some new thing comes out and you're, you know, going to try it out and see what it is and that kind of thing. I know you have for a while been talking about having, you know, healthy relationships with those new technologies, but I feel like a lot of people, at least in the world you've been put in, are like going in the direction of transhumanism, you know, going in the direction of sort of blindly accepting every new technology without skepticism in a way that I think is really dangerous.
Now it's a formal religion, right? Now it's accelerationism has now moved from Nick Land and a couple of guys on acid to a a movement.
Yeah.
It's a large, you know, meaningful number of people in it.
Yeah, so how does this relate to the...
Yeah, will you strap a goon cave to your face and Apple Vision Pro and be walking around Death Black Mountain?
Certainly not. In fact, it's weird because I did actually buy one of the very first VR headsets, because I remember, yeah. Wow, that's amazing. What a possibility.
Yeah.
I may never use an Apple Vision Pro. I certainly am. I'm playing a meaningful role in our community of helping to articulate how do we create the proper liturgical relationship with cell phones, for example, and social media. Mm. And which means, for example, how do we create cultural, like a shared cultural agreement that you don't give your kid an iPhone or a smartphone, full stop, like until they're an adult, maybe. Certainly not until they're like 16 or 17.
Yeah.
To create that cultural, the ritual is really important, because if I try to do it with just my family, then my poor kid ends up being in this weird location because all of her friends are doing something. And then you have to kind of reject all the relationships, which is the wrong thing to do. But if you're actually able to have this happen as part of a cultural moment, then it's strong enough, and then you can actually put things in the right order.
I think those cell phones are going to be like the history is going to judge this generation harshly, but cell phones is going to be one of the top ones, because every parent goes through it, and you watch these kids like visibly like get so much better when you take their phone away from a day. This is what I hear from all my peers. It's like, wow, it's no different than any sort of drug addiction yet, we want them to function, right? We want them to have social lives. And so you have to somehow navigate it. It's not easy.
Yeah, it's a little bit like the analogy is a little bit like if we happen to live in a culture where for some reason every 5-year-old got cocaine.
Yep. Yep.
And if they weren't on cocaine, they were weird. You're like, well, I think your culture may be fucked up. And right. With both. Now, by the way, that's as I'm thinking about it, we do give them Ritalin, and that's also
right.
Fucked up and doomed. Just very clear, it's fucked up and it's doomed. Yeah. So the problem is, how do we not do that? So let's see. It's not clear to me that something like Apple Vision Pro-ish, that category, doesn't have a role to play. This technology thing is not, I'm not anti-technology. That's absurd. We're humans. We can't, clearly we are created to be creators, and technologia is creation. So that has some role to play. Mm-hmm. It certainly is not the role that we've been giving it thus far. So kind of a willy-nilly, mostly greed-driven or recklessness-driven methodology is not the right way to deal with that. It's not connected. But if you think about it, you kind of go back to the first principles. I did a conversation with Jonathan Augeot, one of the first ones we had, where he's like, look, this is, if you look at the story in the Bible, there's two lineages of technology. There's the lineage that contains Cain, and the building of cities and that art, I guess not intended, which ends up in Revelations, right, as a particular version of that ark, ARC. And then you have the lineage of Noah, that ark, ARK, which also ends up in Revelations, right? They face each other. So it's like, this is a problem. This is a thing that's at a biblical level, maybe an eschatological level. So it's not surprising that we struggle with it. And so I'm certainly not technophilic, and I resist it consciously as much as I can. And there's something about it that's necessary. It's part of who we are. Part of our responsibility is to steward dominion. Dominion means stewardship, right? Surface two, not domination. The whole world, the natural world, or creation, of which technology is a particular piece for us. At that point, then I have to kind of wave my hands and say, and how exactly do that now? Is not something that I've been able to really integrate in deeply, other than to say, get our ducks in order, get right with God, get relationship from a churchly, devotional, prayerful perspective, get integrated with the community of other humans. This is kind of like the invert or variation of the Jordan Peterson story, but with God actually in the center of it, not your clean room. Get those things in order, then we can talk about whether or not you should be spending $10 trillion on AI. Yeah. Which won't happen, but that's the way it should be happening.
Yeah, I mean, I like one thing you said in one of the previous podcasts, and I should say for those listening, go listen to the Jim Rutt and the Emerge podcast with Jordan, where he goes through these stories. Faith is like a faculty, And it actually reminds me of one of my favorite books, The Art of Loving by Eric Fromm, where he says love is an art form that you practice and you learn through practice, through action. And there's different forms of it. And the forms of love differ with who the relationship is between. And I would say there's something similar going on with faith in the sense of it's an ongoing practice, it seems like, that then can inform all these other questions. But like you just said, start with this practice.
Yeah, very good point, actually. I like putting love in that same field, because one of the things that I have noticed, and I was actually having a really beautiful conversation with Joe Norman about this yesterday, and he has noticed it as well, and we're noticing kind of the same thing, which is effectively a purposeful misperception of these fundamental elements, of which faith is an example. And the idea that faith in our secular world is taken to mean something like a willful, self-imposed, delusionary belief in things that you know aren't true.
I'd like that definition, that because that is exactly how everybody thinks about it, right?
Yeah, so it's like maximally degenerate belief. Yeah. And of course, that's perfectly not at all what it is. It is, in fact, more akin to hearing, more akin to learning how to listen to music and play an instrument. And it's a faculty that is innate to us that we have. And it allows us to begin to navigate aspects of reality that our other sensorium are not the right ones to navigate. And it has this sense, like this sense of solidity. Yeah, you can ground on these things as you build up. But love is the same thing, right? Our poor children have been taught this saccharine version of love that has very little to do with the richness of what love actually is. So like our culture has captured, a demonic culture has captured and appropriated the most important things and given us back a version which is simple enough for our minds to grasp, but actually because it is so simple and is so much of a simulacrum, separates us all the more effectively from the thing itself.
Yep. I think one thing that keeps coming back up in this conversation that I just want to explicitly say is I think there's a kind of rationalistic thinking that always sort of ends up with this very flattened monoculture conception of things that are actually quite deep in context, but decontextualized, they just become really, really silly, flat versions of themselves that then everybody sort of takes as truth. You know, women should be equal to men. And it's a very flat, it's such a flat conception of what the relationship between a man and a woman can be like. In a specific context, the differentiation is really rich and full and helpful and functional. But
like Jim asked Jordan about, you know, do you think there's a God in the sky, a guy with throwing down lightning bolts? And it's like, no, but like I want to yell at Jim. I'm like, I don't know, but I do believe I do have a father that loves me that I didn't know that I had. Right. And so. Like there's a 4D version of the, of these things too that are that are under there if you're willing to explore it, I think.
Yeah.
Actually, the notion of like a categorical subordination of 4D to 2D, categorical subordination of complexity and of contextualization to decontextualization as an epistemological mandate.
Yeah.
That's, I think, is the key problematic, is that we live in a world where decontextualization is epistemology.
Yep.
Therefore, what happens is we intrinsically flatten everything, and then we try to regurgitate some version of what might be a vague simulation of what rightness looks like in this flattened space. But no, contextualization. Like we need an epistemology of contextualization. Because that's what reality actually is.
Yeah, yeah. It reminds me of I got a friend, Baron Morgan, who was from Appalachia, and this decontextualized idea that we need to solve climate change with solar panels, and that is the solution to climate the environmental problem. And then taken abstracted and then put back into Appalachia means blowing off mountaintops. And then she's talking to local people who have gotten this decontextualized idea in their head, and they're like, blowing off our local mountains is good because it's for the environment, like as this decontextualized thing. But then she talks to other people, says, just blowing off the mountaintops is bad for the environment because those are the environment. And so it's like we have sort of taken away our ability to see with our own eyes the actual context and to trust our own instinct and our own understanding of beauty and truth and what right relationship looks like. Okay, so we're wrapping up now. any final thoughts that you for sure want to get on the record while we're talking? Any ideas for those who are listening and kind of have their wheels spinning about religion and Christianity, like how to take a first step in exploration?
I'll handle next steps because I thought about this a lot.
Okay.
So like one thing is if you're thinking about Christianity and you know a Christian, they would love to talk to you. It's weird, right? I got invited at work to like the employee Bible study. And I was shocked. Like one, I thought they were like reading a whole book of the Bible at one time. They would just go over like one verse.
Yeah.
And I was absolutely shocked how happy they were to just answer whatever dumb question I had. And so that's a big thing. And so talk to other Christians if you know them, and they'll steer you in the right direction for what's right for you in the context that you're in, right? And the second thing is, you do got to go to church at some point. I think it's pretty hard. It can't be an intellectual exercise. It can't just be reading books. I think that is a huge thing. So pick a church, go to it. I don't think it matters a ton. There's a huge constellation of denominations with all of them full of people thinking deeply about things. So go to a church and try it out. And you know, the coffee's not always great. Jordan's working on that. But you'll find real people for sure. And that's where it starts.
Yeah, I would say to the degree that you can, make yourself open to the notion that you are in fact loved. I think that that's actually the splinter in the soul of so many people. And just to be allowed, just to allow the possibility that you are in fact actually loved, and it, like you. And then the rest can start to happen on its own.
I love it. All right. Well, Jordan, thank you so much for your time. This was great. Thanks, Tim, for sharing your story. It's super inspirational. I really appreciate it. Thanks.
I enjoyed it. Thanks.
I really enjoyed it. Thank you very much. It was quite heartening, quite encouraging.